May it please the Court. Your Honors, today we are here to deal with this Court's 2011 decision written by Judge Breckenridge and Celis Garcia on several levels. There exists, as my application for transfer says, a conflict between this case and many other cases being direct appeal cases. And this Court had before it a case approximately maybe a year and a half ago of Mallow v. State, which was a 2915 case. Really, to be the first post-conviction case this Court would have addressed under the what I'll call Celis Garcia principles, because it was a pre-Celis Garcia case, but still dealing with the same principles of jury unanimity from Article 1, Section 22A that had been going on for nearly 100 years in this state since the enactment of the Constitutional Amendment. That case was decided on this Court on a procedural issue that the ineffective assistance of counsel claim was not preserved. Today, we're not going to be here talking about preservation because Ed's case is preserved. And so for the first time that I can tell, this Court gets to deal with the Celis Garcia type issue of jury unanimity in a 2915 case. The first thing I'd like to say is I think the state, and I mentioned this in the reply brief, I think the state misconstrues what the claim is. This is not a claim that Mr. Williams, the trial counsel, failed to object based on Celis Garcia. And I double-checked. I did not write the 2915 motion, but I did a search and find just to double-check that I would be right when saying this statement up here before you today. The words Celis Garcia versus State of Missouri do not appear in the Rule 2915 amended motion. It was very carefully pled, as was Celis Garcia, because Celis Garcia didn't exist before you all wrote the opinion, that the verdict directing handbook instruction, the instruction that teaches lawyers how to build a verdict director, how to challenge a verdict director, had a notes on use that told you in order to ensure jury unanimity, you could modify as to place, as to time.
That's MAI criminal you're talking about?
Yes, I am. Sometimes I forget the exact number, but it's out there, 30204 maybe. But whatever, I don't think this is a test on whether I can remember all the MIIN numbers. If so, I might flunk. But that was out there.
Right. And isn't that often a strategic decision?
It can be. But here, it's not. And I'd like to clarify.
How do we know that it wasn't?
Well, because Mr. Williams told us it wasn't. Mr. Williams, the state.
Was he believed? How do we know that he was believed in that regard?
Well, first of all, if you're talking about the trial court, the motion court, they did not side with him.
Right.
They did not. I think they kind of had their cake and ate it, too, because they didn't, even though, and there is a second issue, Mr. Hober's case, which I will entertain questions about. I shouldn't say we're only here on one thing today. We were here on two issues. But they clearly believed him that he tried to do the best that he could in raising the second issue. But the issue I take with that is, how can you make, because he said, and did you fail to make an objection based on trial strategy? No. Did you consider objecting to 8 and 10 on the basis the verdict directors did not specify a particular incident? No. I think there's some confusion through the state's brief of what he didn't recall. What he didn't recall is whether...
Even assuming that he vehemently, in some circumstance, denied that something was a matter of trial strategy, that's the burden of proof on the movement, correct?
Yes, but we also asked him, he could not recall comparing or even considering objecting to the verdict directors based on the notes on use. And how in the world can you make a strategic decision without considering? It's like the body of case law that says you can't make a strategic decision that you're going to put on witness Buchan without even investigating and looking at and seeing what he has to say. How
so
can
you're arguing because you're arguing that no reasonable attorney that could not be reasonable trial strategy because the trial court could have disbelieved his testimony that it was.
It could have believed his testimony, and I think that's also what. Pardon me for the mic not tracking me. I also think it's what the Barmettler case from the Eastern District says. Barmettler dealt with a case somewhat similar, except for the prejudice prong, to this, Priscellus Garcia, and talking about that a reasonable attorney would have used, absent any compelling trial strategy. And he had none, and we can't substitute. He said he did not have.
But the trial court could have disbelieved him. Attorneys have been known to suggest after the fact they had no trial strategy.
They have been known. Yeah. But I will also just say the record doesn't demonstrate that. I mean, I've had him. Mr. Williams was a squirrely witness on the stand, saying one thing, denying, you know, pulling rabbits out of his head. I understand
What's
that.
What's our standard of review?
Beg your pardon?
What's our standard of review?
Clearly erroneous.
Counsel, the state argues that Celis Garcia was not handed down until 2 years after trial. And how can counsel be convicted of an error when the law has not even been announced?
Well, because that's not what the claim is. And Celis Garcia, like other opinions of this court, is a clarification of longstanding existing law. Celis Garcia, I think, was a wake-up call where through the pen of Judge Breckinridge, they kind of gave us a slap in the brain and said, hey, y'all, remember that this is out here, and it's been out here for a long time.
Isn't Celis Garcia also, I agree with you, I don't think it changed the law at all, but it very much points out the reality in these types of cases, that if you start objecting to places and times, you're more likely to draw 10 or 15 counts as opposed to 2 or 3.
Well,
and that's what happened in Celis Garcia.
It is indeed, and I know that because I represented Ms. Celis Garcia on the second go around, and she had 17 to be exact. But this is that a risk that we can't predict the future. I have yet to meet anybody that can. Can Mr. Williams stand there and say, well, I'm not going to object to this, or this is going to be prejudicial because Dwight Scroggins may in the future decide to do that?
Well, and the issue at the time the objection is made, there are already a number of charges before. So if the court rules correctly, only the charges that are pending, that are being tried,
correct,
are the charges that can be tried.
And the state has to elect. The state would have to, at that point, take the two counts and do kitchen and kitchen, kitchen and bathroom, kitchen and the permutations are endless.
The negative consequences to the client only occurs if they decide to appeal
Correct.
Reverse the judgment.
Correct. But we're talking about in this moment, in this trial. Judge Wilson?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Could you address the state's argument that because there was an admission of two inappropriate touchings, that prejudice
Well, I think you have to look at what Ed told Detective Coates. And I think you also have to look at, not only did Ed deny it at trial, but Ed denied it before that to Detective Wilson, to Trenny Wilson. And there was, even though, as I recall, Mr. Williams, the trial attorney's testimony, was that his trial theme. His job at trial was to discredit the witnesses. He also put forth a defense of false confession. And let's say that issue isn't, so that's a reality of it. I mean, he is arguing that you can't really believe Ed either. But let's say we take that out of it. He confesses, I think, would I be up here? Would you have taken this if Detective Coates had gotten him to confess to two times in the kitchen? I mean, I think it probably surprised everybody that that little girl got up there and said, twice in the kitchen, nowhere else. I mean, I wasn't there. I don't know. It was unexpected. But yes, he said that. So the evidence, let's say there's only kitchen and bathroom, which there's not. There's multiple other places. You know, unanimity isn't a math problem of six people believe kitchen, six people believe bathroom, 6 and 6 equals 12, 12 is unanimous. That's not how it works. Sorry, I'm leaning too close.
I mean, you're mixing the future and the past a little bit. The jury wasn't asked to differentiate time and place.
Well, that's the problem.
And he confessed to two separate violations in a place in a time. So
correct.
For
but
what the jury was asked to consider, why was there?
Well, there's no. We don't have. You know, the evidence we need to answer that question is two things. The evidence we need to answer whether they all believed Ed. Hey, Ed Hober confessed 12 for the bathroom. Two times, guilty, guilty. What we need is a signed verdict form for both verdicts, 8 and 10 instructions. We need that jury unanimity instruction, and we need two verdict directors that say place. That would tell us that jury went to that room, and despite all the other evidence, that jury agreed that Ed Hober's confession put the nail in the coffin.
If I understand you correctly, you're also saying that he confessed, the confession was not a concession because later on he withdrew the confession and said it was false. So you can't say no prejudice from the failure to distinguish between incidents and the jury instruction because he did not concede any incident occurred.
Correct, twice. He first said it before the confession occurred. He said it to Trini Wilson, which statement came first. And then he said to,
I understand your argument. Thank you.
Right, thank you.
I'm sorry.
The clock confused me. I'm sorry.
And whose burden is it to demonstrate prejudice? Yours or the state's?
Mine.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
May it please the court. The first thing you look at, well, first I want to say that sometimes in these post-conviction cases, things get way more theoretical, especially on appeal, than what a trial attorney in the middle of trial would actually think about. First, it's the defendant's burden to show that counsel acted incompetently, that under prevailing professional norms, the counsel should have immediately objected to these verdict directors that were identically worded except for the count number.
And doesn't the underlying principle of Celis-Garcia, where this court found that the trial court committed plain error in not recognizing that, doesn't that finding that there's established law that you cannot convict a defendant of multiple acts without identifying what those acts are, so the jury has to be unanimous?
True, and that's true, and that Celis-Garcia wasn't decided until 2 years after this trial.
But it was decided because that was the established law on the basis of plain error, which is very rare.
I agree, Your Honor, and the court cited a case, I think it was a 1912 case, that talked about unanimous jury verdicts.
And the MAI instruction says you should distinguish. So that was in effect at the time of the trial.
That's true, Your Honor.
So
there is no question.
So Salas-Garcia didn't create new law.
It did not create new law, but
it said follow the law.
Yes, but state's position would be it was a watershed moment. It was the first time where we had the phrase multiple acts cases was used and talked about how you deal with these cases in child sexual abuse situations. So while it didn't change the law, what the law was at the time, there were several cases that cited in the brief. There's Staples, Rudd, Birch, were all identically worded verdict directors, two count charges, where the courts had found no plain error because there was no risk that the jury was confused or didn't unanimously agree.
But I think the question goes to, there's prejudice for preserved error, there's plain error, and Strickland error kind of comes, we have cases saying it falls in between those two, basically, in terms of difficulty of proving. So if we said it's plain error, isn't it then necessarily serious enough, if it wasn't trial strategy, to be Strickland error?
No.
Okay.
Because there are two different things going on. It's different in a direct appeal than, and that's what confuses me about the defendant's transfer application. The Court of Appeals has, since Salas-Garcia, taken a look at, because of what Salas-Garcia talked about, that Salas-Garcia was not a case where it was just a general denial, I didn't do anything.
The Court of Appeals has believed the only time Salas-Garcia applies is if the person said, I didn't do this act here or this act there. That was a circumstance in Salas-Garcia, and they have taken that to be the basis of Salas-Garcia.
And I think the state's confusion on that is all those cases are at least, most of them I handled, and I'm pretty sure in most of them there were applications for transfer which were denied, that those cases would have been the appropriate case to determine, well, has the Court of Appeals gone too far, or has they misinterpreted?
And like the U.S. Supreme Court, our cases say denial of transfer means we deny transfer.
And I understand,
not presidential.
And I understand that, Your Honor. And what I'm trying to explain is the difference between a direct appeal, manifest injustice is concerned, where the considerations are different than in a 2915 case, where the prejudice is, if the trial counsel would have objected to these identically worded verdict directors, the court would have sustained the objection.
Well, and wouldn't it be an instructional error in that sense? It's presumed prejudice on direct appeal if the instructions were wrong, correct?
Right.
And then here, there's no presumption of prejudice. It has to be demonstrated by the movement.
Right.
Number one, that it wasn't trial strategy, and then number two, that it was prejudice.
And if trial counsel would have objected based on the existing state of the law and the existing MAI instructions, the court should have done something to differentiate the two counts. But that's not the question. If the objection would have been successful on a 2915, the question is, since the counsel did not object, did these verdict directors, is there a reasonable probability, did the defendant prove a reasonable probability that he would have been acquitted or that there was a non-unanimous jury verdict? That's the difference between a Salas-Garcia type issue on direct appeal, looking at it from manifest injustice, and a 2915 where the defendant has the burden to prove that there was a non-unanimous verdict or that the reasonable probability exists. Here, even though Salas-Garcia hadn't been decided and the guidance from this court about the prosecutor electing which counts that they were focusing on for the jury, that occurred in the prosecutor's closing argument in this case, where the prosecutor essentially focused the jury's attention on the defendant has a signed written confession saying, I did this act on two occasions in the bathroom when I was helping the victim go to the bathroom. That, I believe, under Salas-Garcia.
But the jury, I mean, if I understand it, the victim said it happened twice in the kitchen in testimony. Is that right?
That's true. That's true.
So how do we know which of those the jury went on, which incidents they came back with guilty verdicts on?
We don't. We would never know, and that's why we talk about, and Strickland talks about, what's the reasonable probability. The defendant has to prove a reasonable probability that this.
So you can never meet Strickland prejudice in a case in which the instruction is mistaken in this way.
No, you could. You could, if you had a situation like a Celis Garcia situation, where it was very clear that there was the evidence pertaining to the different locations where the acts occurred, there was specific, distinct evidence of why it was not credible that an act occurred in the bathroom, because in Celis Garcia, grandma's room was right next to it. Grandma would have heard it, and grandma said she never heard anything. Or in the enclosed porch that was all glassed in that people could have seen. Or the bedroom with the use of
that. Well, that doesn't help you to determine what the jury found, though.
No, well, what it helps the defendant to show is that there is a reasonable probability on that record that they did not reach a unanimous verdict.
But these two identical verdict directors with no time or place identified in the verdict directors, doesn't that make it highly unlikely that he could be found guilty on one and acquitted on the other?
Not on this. I don't believe on this record, because what the compelling thing on this record is the confession. I did it twice in the bathroom. And the prosecutor
what
telling
what about the other evidence from the victim and from the therapist? Or
well, and it's, if the
it showed other rooms and other locations.
Well, and what that's what the victim said. The victim said at trial it happened more than once in the kitchen. Then she, within a few questions, said, "Well, maybe not in the kitchen." Her out-of-court statements was it happened more than once. In the bedroom, in the living room, in the kitchen, in the bathtub. So if I could switch back to
And did the defendant say that, well, he just confessed because the police were questioning him and he wanted to get out of there and that kind of thing, and that he did not really perform these acts?
Right. And
I'm not clear why the jury then had to find that his confession was true as opposed to his other claim. I mean, the jury certainly could have found that, but you're saying we have to assume they did, and that's why there's no prejudice.
Well, I'm saying there is no reasonable probability. Is there a reasonable probability that this jury believed his testimony, that his confession was coerced, but then believed the victim's testimony?
So you can't win a post-conviction if you ever confessed at some point.
Well, I suppose you can't really say that. You can't really say that, but on this record, it's such a strong confession. It's written and it's in his own hand. He signed it, and he admitted to the two distinct acts. The prosecutor told the jury to focus on these two distinct acts in the bathroom. The question is, did the motion court, was it a clearly erroneous determination that the motion court reached in saying that there's no reasonable probability that this jury was not unanimous in.
Isn't the reason that we require the verdict director to state what acts the jury has to find unanimously is because this kind of transcript absolutely lends itself to the jury saying, we don't know exactly what he did, but boy, we believe he did stuff, and you know, he at least did two things. We don't know exactly what they were, but we think he's guilty. I mean, isn't that the whole purpose of preventing that and require them to find, he is constitutionally entitled to have them find which act it was and to find that unanimously.
Right, he's constitutionally entitled to that. But he doesn't have to avail himself of it. If, that's why, I'm going back to what I said before about if this had been case been taken on direct appeal and manifest injustice considered on this record, The argument could still be that this is so distinct from what happened in Celis Garcia that there was no manifest injustice in this case. But the court's inquiry about, well, we want to make sure that, you know, these things do not occur, that's different than saying that an attorney in the midst of a trial was ineffective, because in this situation, the only thing that could have happened, if there had been an objection, what the court could have done is given alternative verdict directors. So she said it happened more than once. He said it happened more than once. So that's at least two times. Two verdict directors for each room, kitchen, bathroom, bedroom, living room. And eight to 10 alternative verdict directors telling the jury, if you don't find this, well, what about this? On down the line, and all that does is focus the jury on how many times the witnesses said this occurred. If I had been representing this defendant, I would not have made an objection. In fact, you don't make an objection because what's the risk you're running that the jury was not going to be unanimous versus the benefit that might inure, for example, of holding that objection and waiting till appeal, which that's where the trial strategy comes in, and that's why you can't. The defense counsel here said, I don't remember having a trial strategy, why I did this. Well, if you leave the whether a trial strategy occurred or not to defense counsel, another defense counsel would have said just what I did, well, no, I didn't want to object to that because I didn't want to focus the jury's attention on it. You've left the decision of what's trial strategy solely in the hands of what the defense counsel testifies. And Strickland talks about whether the presumption is there was trial strategy in failing to act or in acting, in this case, failing to act. And might there have been, that's the phrase that Strickland used, that there might have been a reasonable trial strategy decision. On this record, it appears that there would have been, because, again, the only thing that could have happened here on an objection is you end up with a bunch of alternative verdict directors, which doesn't inure to the defense's benefit.
Before you run out of time, can you discuss the Western District's decision in Le Sieur? Do you think that's consistent with Celis Garcia?
I think it's consistent with the wording, with the way Celis Garcia, the opinion, examines the evidence. There's one line in Celis Garcia, which this is not a case where the defense was a general, it didn't occur, the victim is lying. And then the court then goes on to point out all these very discrete, distinct evidentiary details of Celis Garcia. In Le Sieur, the defense was, this victim's lying. She's got something against me. She's lying about all of it. So when the evidence in that case showed there were two locations and two acts happened in two different locations, and the witness in Le Sieur was a teenage victim as opposed to a young child, a 4 or 5 year old in this case. And on that record, when the defense was totally that we didn't do this and that no evidentiary details were brought out, like in this case, there were no evidentiary details brought out about the different locations where the touching might have occurred, that the Court of Appeals decision in that case and other ones like it was consistent with that language in Celis Garcia. And if it had not been, then one might have expected that a case on direct appeal would have been taken to clarify if there was any confusion by the Court of Appeals. Unless
Thank
the court
you.
Has any other questions. Thank you.
Counselor, do you agree that the trial record would have supported multiple verdict directed instructions in this case had there been an objection to these instructions solely being given?
If that's what was asked for, yes, but that's the claim is that but it makes a difference. I mean, I agree that it is, but my claim is that they should have modified the existing verdict directors to name a time or a place.
That's one of the things that the trial court could have done, or the state could have said, well, how many of these are supported and offered 6 to 8 to 10. If there was an objection, that's certainly what could have happened based on this record.
It could have, even though that's not what the claim is, it could have. And I don't think that gets us any closer.
But if you get back to what the claim is, though, the claim is that he should have objected to these.
And he should have requested that the existing verdict directors be modified. But let's say we did have all this. I don't think it gets it any closer, because Judge Breckenridge is spot on. The problem with this case is exactly what you said. It's like you're sitting there reading my mind. This case is like Silas Garcia. Before today, to be ready, I wrote down on a piece of paper all the different evidence, facts, where they came from. And a lot of this is evidence that the state puts on and the state elicits from SM. And so it's a lot the state's evidence, not the defense evidence.
Well, no, certainly. But again, if we get to a situation where we're trying to offer jury instructions in the heat of trial, and the state is permitted to offer an instruction on every possibility that's supported by the evidence, I mean, that's the likely scenario that you'll get. You'll get alternative instructions, or the state could say, well, Judge, I'll just take the two confessions. I understand your argument, but what I don't understand is not an honest concession that this type of decision has real ramifications, and that it's certainly a matter of trial strategy, whether or not you want your client facing two verdict directors or 10.
Well, I think if he faces 10, we still have the same prejudice problem. It does not focus the jury on anyone. It shows the mess of evidence on the wall. And it only, you know, the math on unanimity in reverse is it only takes one soldier. It is reasonably likely that one person is going to be so confused by this mess of evidence that they're going to say, I don't know where it happened. I can't agree to any of this. And I think that's highly likely. I think you need to look at a couple things. The statement was not in Ed's handwriting. Page 13 of my brief, Detective Coates wrote it, transcript 397, 385, States Exhibit 6. And again, Mr. Williams did not say that he could not remember. The could not remember comes in when looking at the instructions. He said, no, he did not have a reason. And I will end. My time is up. Look at Barmettler. Barmettler is the Eastern District case that tracks this. And Barmettler says there were two acts. There wasn't enough emphasis on all the other acts, like in Celis Garcia and like in Mr. Hober's case. So I think the Barmettler case would be very instructed in giving the relief that Ed so richly deserves, which is protection of his right to a unanimous jury verdict. Thank you.
Case will be submitted.